Hello and welcome to Tomorrow. I'm not your host, Joshua Sapolsky. This week on the show, we talk about Bon Appetit, the DNC, and Analog's customer service. I don't want to waste 1 minute. Let's get right into it. Well, hello and welcome back to another episode of Tomorrow. I am obviously not our illustrious host, Joshua Sapolsky, as he is off trying to have some kind of summer vacation with his family, such as you can in these quote-unquote trying times. But in his stead, we have a great guest in the form of Evan Rogers, editor at Input. Hello, Evan.
Hi.
How's it going?
It's going well. It's going well.
So you've been on the show before, so everyone should be at least mildly familiar with you. But do you want to tell us a little bit about how you came to work at Input?
Sure. So I have been sort of in the technology news publishing industry, I guess, for a little while. You know, I started at The Verge, then did some hard time at Vice, and then was at Engadget, and now I'm here as the guides editor. And I write about a lot of different types of like hard gadgets. You know what I mean? Like the last thing that I just put up was a network attached storage guide, which, you know.
Yeah, you're like the world is ending and you need like a pocket knife, dude.
Yes.
Or exactly. we're like you have 15 televisions and you want them all to become a circular ball around you and watch them at once.
Exactly.
Evan's like,
exactly,
yes. I got it.
If you need to make the like panopticon chair, I'm there. I'm like, I gotcha.
Yeah. So this week has been so much. I mean, right when we started this conversation, before we started recording, you were like, what day is it? And I was like, Thursday. And I only knew that because I woke up today and was like, Friday. And John was like, no.
But for real, though, it's like, I mean, we've all, you know, a little peek behind the scenes here, but like we have all been like pushing as hard as humanly possible, kind of because Josh is not here.
Yeah, I mean, we've got to show him up.
Yeah, I mean, for real. You know? But we've had the pedal to the metal.
Yeah, no, this week has been crazy work-wise, like unreal amounts of things that we're doing and that are happening. Honestly, please visit the website because there's a lot of really good shit up there right now. But also, we have the DNC that happened every night this week. And if there's no other way to end your hard work day, it's watching the Democrats like, I don't know, watching the Democrats do a victory lap for a contest that they haven't won yet.
Yes, that is actually such a good description of it.
It's kind of a trip because you go from like a really moving speech about gun control from like Gabby Giffords and you're like, wow, you know what? We got to get it together, guys. Like, yeah, we're the sane party. Like, let's be liberal.
I watched the first one and I can't do it. I just couldn't do it last night. Like, I know. I heard the news stories about it like directly afterwards, like, I don't know, like 11 o'clock last night. And after the first one, I just can't.
There's moments where you're like on the verge of tears and then they smash cut to Nancy Pelosi, like in a montage, putting on sunglasses and getting on a private plane and being like girl boss. And you're like,
I know.
Well, I don't want to hear from this real estate tycoon about how she's having a feud with another real estate tycoon. Like,
it's not just that it's like cringe to the absolute max, which it absolutely is. It's also like the whole concept of this convention is like,
it's an infomercial
begging Republicans. Like, instead of like, you know, Trump basically rallied a core base, didn't give a fuck about anyone else, right? And, you know, just got his like neat and tidy 42% or whatever it was, right? Mm-hmm. And instead of activating the Democratic base, which is a diverse coalition, as they love to remind us, you know, but instead of like getting Democrats excited, they're like, Republicans, please, we're begging you. Please just make this end.
I mean, someone tweeted, I think Mark Harris tweeted last night, like, hey, extremely online leftists, just because you don't like this doesn't mean it's for you woke people. And it's like, well, then who is it for? Is it for John Kasich fans? Is it for, like, my dad who is never going to vote for a Democrat? Like, I don't know what what is this? Because, like, isn't it so much easier to get the people who are already inclined to like you excited and, like, intent on getting out there to vote than it is to, like, completely change someone's entire worldview? Like, the next logical step from I love Trump is I'm ambivalent and not going to vote. And so, like, let's get those people there as opposed to, like let's get people to just be ambivalent on that side and excited on our side, as opposed to, like, trying to do the full conversion. Like, that's crazy.
I don't know, a very well-educated and highly paid person came up with this strategy, and it didn't work
in 2016. Why would it work now? But the thing is, the polling numbers, Trump's polling numbers are not that far off from where Obama's were at the exact same time in his presidency. And, like, the whole world is much worse. So it doesn't seem like that's going to change anyone's mind. Like, that doesn't seem like world events or evidence or facts has done anything to inform voters.
That's the thing, is I just saw somebody, I forget who tweeted this, but, you know, there was a new poll that showed that, like, you know, Trump's approval ratings are, like, down to 40%. And, like, that, you know, the thrust of the tweet was like, wow, like, you know, like, you know, that's really sinking down. And I'm thinking, like, we're in the middle of a pandemic. Like, I don't know how many 9/11s worth of deaths have happened so far.
Record joblessness, like, on the brink of a homelessness crisis. Everyone's dying. The economy's shot.
And 42% of people are like, this is what I wanted. This is what I would like to have happening.
because they can lie to themselves and say none of this is his fault and he's doing the best that anyone could, which is just
in fact it's the Democrats. You know, if the Democrats would just stop you know, blocking him, then he could fix everything, but you know, that's not happening.
So, like, facts are they're completely invulnerable when it comes to facts. So at that point, like, okay, 80% of Democrats want Medicare for all. Why doesn't Joe Biden just go up there and say, like, we're in a pandemic. I'm going to give everybody health care if you go and vote. If you go and vote, you won't have to have that midnight worry about whether that, like, headache you keep getting is a brain tumor and it's going to bankrupt your whole family to even go get it checked out, let alone get chemo. Like, that worry of yours will be gone. If you go out and vote, like, your kids will absolutely get the best healthcare for the rest of their lives. All it takes is for you to go out and vote. People would fucking go vote. But if you go up there and you're like, people love their health insurance companies, and what we're going to do is create a tax incentive credit plan for people who need to get healthcare to pay $900 a month for bare minimum entry level healthcare, from which you can earn better. It's like, what the fuck are you talking about?
Sink into the goo. Just, you know that movie Under the Skin?
Yes.
Just where there's the black goo. You're just slowly walking into the goo.
Josh, if Josh were here, he would be yelling at us, like, you know, be happy with what you got and Kamala is inspiring and stuff. And, like, listen, Tony, if you're buying into all of Josh's bag of tricks there, God bless. I mean, we're all voting for the same people. I just think, like, I want us to win really badly. And it seems pretty obvious how to get people excited and unified and, like, and impassioned. I mean, it could be the fucking Pringles can man up there saying that he's going to give everyone healthcare, and the Bernie bros, quote unquote, would get right in line and be like, yeah, let's fucking get everyone healthcare. But the fact that for me, I know I keep crowing about healthcare specifically on this show, but it's because it's such an obvious example. And we're in a pandemic. Sorry.
Well, and, like, no, I mean, I just think that it's difficult for people who have full-time jobs and they, you know, they're healthy, they, you know, number one, people that have full-time jobs and health insurance who are healthy think that their insurance is good, but they have not put it to the test. You know what I mean? If you, like, shatter your leg in a car accident or, like, get cancer, like, think of, you know, then you'll realize that, you know, your health plan that you thought was fine for just getting checkups and flu shots is a little bit weaker than you might have thought. But, like, those people do not think about the people who, like, you know, there have been times where I've been freelancing where it's like, if I get sick or like if I fall off a boosted board or something, it is over. Do you know what I mean? Like, if you can't empathize with those people, it's you're not in the same place.
I mean, like for a year, I had health insurance in between my parents being on my parents' plan and then not having health insurance. And then I didn't have health insurance until I got on Medicaid in New York mm-hmm. State. And then that was really great. And then I lost that because I made too much money doing freelance at one point, and mm-hmm. I knew yep. I was going to be starting a full-time job. So then there was this grace period of 6 months, and I swear to God, every time I got a cold, every time I fucking fell down, I was like, this is it. This is the end of my dreams. Like, we're done. Like, pack it up. You're moving back to your parents' basement. Like, the fact that's the case for someone who trips or falls, like that this kind of like lifestyle change could occur is completely, it's unconscionable in the richest country in the world, especially during a global pandemic. And
I saw the slid pass. So admittedly, I did not look into this. I don't remember which of, you know, the Biden campaign's, you know, stooges said this, but there was some chatter on my timeline earlier this morning about, you know, taking on the federal deficit during Biden's term. And the word austerity like rolled by, and like my brain just like started leaking. And
Thatcherisms. The thing is that like,
I know exactly what is happening, but like, you know, even still, you know, just the other day, I just moved to a new apartment. You know, I just sent in all my documentation for like changing my address for like, you know, my voter registration and everything like that. And it is a huge pain in the ass to do. If and we're not even being like actively suppressed by New York State, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. But you know, we have the situation on our hands where it's like, Biden is not the best. What I saw this morning about just like some Thatcherisms just sliding past casually, classic Democrat stuff, you know? Like, it's, you know, when Josh is like, you gotta grit your teeth and do it, it's like nobody's not talking about that. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Oh my God. Nobody's even fucking, the people who are considering not voting are the people who are going to find a reason every fucking year. Every year.
Exactly.
It's some like fucking Jill Stein Green Party. Like, and you know what? Fucking do you, Marianne Williamson. I hope the like spinning in a field and praying and doing backflips like works out, but that's always going to exist.
Yes, that's what I'm saying is that like, you don't need to worry about those people, because those people are always going to be in their own little like contrarian world. But everyone else is like, ooh, I am close to death. We are close to a fascist police state. Maybe we should act.
My bigger worry is like voter suppression. And
I mean, the post office thing is making me livid, Ryan. Like,
well, so that's what I was going to go into next, was like that the post office is being ripped apart piece by piece. And it, like before our eyes, like brazenly. And it's, we're discussing post, whether or not we should have the post. Like, we're talking about whether or not we should have mail in a pandemic.
It's really interesting because, like, you know, one of the things that the Pod Save America boys said the other day was that, like, I think it was an astute point that like Democrats are obsessed with symbols, which is, heard that and I was like, wow, true. And it is, you know, like there's like on a lot of the reporting this morning, people were talking about like the backgrounds of all the speakers at the convention yesterday.
Yeah.
But it's like, guys, relax. Just, it's fine. We don't,
I mean, the fine. Hot takes in either direction about the fact that Elizabeth Warren behind her in the classroom she was giving a speech from, like had aligned the alphabet letters to say BLM. Yes. It's like, in either direction, like, do you think that's a silly little like ridiculous like, oh, they're doing fan service, what the fuck thing? Okay, do you think it's an important statement that she's defiantly putting in there? Like, okay,
no, somebody
who the fuck cares,
a campaign manager was like, oh, it'd be fun if we did BLM, and then they did it, and then that was it.
But
no, so what I was gonna say though is like, this is just such an interesting time to be going through this situation with the post, because at least for me, because I just finished Death Stranding. And I started reading this novel that like may or may not have played some part in inspiring Death Stranding, called The Postman. And like there's something so on the nose. I mean, you know, before the internet, the post was literally the connective tissue in the country, right? Like, it is literally the thing that connected us. And just the...
I mean, mail predates railways. Mail predates telegraphs. Like, without the mail as a basic form of communication or moving things, none of this exists.
No, I mean, like, all the letters from, you know, the founding points in the beginning of our country, like, it's just, there's something so perfect about, you know, this administration trying to rip apart the core original connective tissue of the country. And like, having just played Death Stranding, which for anybody who's listening who doesn't really know what's going on in Death Stranding, because it's, you know, Kojima's sort of, you know, from the outside, it's a little bit difficult to get in. But like, basically, you know, America is fractured and shattered. Everyone has withdrawn from, you know, the larger society into their little bunkers, and everyone's become divided. If this seems on the nose, it actually, the plot of it is actually extremely on the nose.
And also, and this went to development before any of this even happened. Yes, and was released before the pandemic.
This is true. And then you literally have to, like, by delivering people these packages, you're like reminding them that, you know, they have these like personal revelations of like, hey, I don't have to be, you know, I don't have to hide in my little bunker anymore. There is, you know, there can be a wider society. We can work together. The Postman, the novel, is also kind of similar in that way too, where a guy is just like a, you know, there's like a extreme war that destroys everything and fractures the whole country. And a guy just like, who's just like surviving in the woods and like almost got killed, just like finds a Jeep with a dead postman in it, and he steals his clothes because somebody else stole his clothes. And like, just by pretending to be the mail, you know, he brings these communities, you know, back together. You know, he's just sort of living this lie where he's the postman so that he can get by, so he can get some like supplies of different things. And like, just the idea of being connected with these other little communities brings people together. You know what I mean? And it sounds corny, but like, there is something so perfect in this moment where like the desperation for Trump to get reelected, to do, by the way, to do a job he is not interested in doing, you know, is, it's just so out there. It's just, we live in the craziest time. It's just so crazy to think about.
Yes. Trump's fascism, it's not as if it's like a mastermind evil plan that he has, right? Like, it's a combination of the people around him having a mastermind evil plan to create a fascist police state, and his own instincts as a narcissist sociopath, which I do believe that he is, to like, those instincts lead you to that exact political outcome. And when you have basically limitless power and everyone saying yes to you, that's where you're going to get to. And so like, the post office, he's taking it apart because he can't control it. And so it's just yet another thing that like, it's not that he doesn't want people dependent on the government. It's that he wants to be the government and have everyone depend on him and like love him, and everything goes to him and through him, and he controls everything. And the post office is this giant thing, similar to what he's doing on the internet, which we should talk about, that he has no control over, that essentially exists to facilitate other people having power. And like, he cannot have that because, I mean, that's the exact opposite of his, what he sees as success.
I mean, I think there's sort of a big thing happening that where like, you know, I think that boomers got the best public education that the, you know, that the United States has ever offered, right? And then they turned around and defunded public schools. And, you know, I went to public school in like 7 states, you know? I have a pretty good sampling of the East Coast public school experience.
Why did you move around so much?
Well, my dad worked in explosives. I mean, that's true. But no, he was an explosives engineer, so like blasting and, you know, geology and that sort of thing. And after 9/11, you know, because the regulations got so strict, it consolidated the industry from like thousands and thousands of small explosives mom and pop shops to like, there's only one, or like the one or two now. So that's, you know, We were chasing the end of an industry post 9/11, which, you know, that's how it is. But, you know, I think that like, we really have a situation on our hands where, you know, as the quality of education declined. Like, you know, and I went to school, I went to business school, right? Like I went to school for economics, right? And I still didn't get a particularly good business education, you know, to be totally honest with you. But like when Trump said, I want to run this country like a business, everyone should have had the level of education they need to understand that there are some things that cannot be run like a business. FedEx and UPS do not run last mile mail or packages in extremely rural areas, right? Because it is just not profitable.
It's not profitable.
It's not profitable, right? Like the reason that we pay taxes is because we agree that everyone deserves a certain standard of living, be it electricity, you know, or just getting the mail, right? Running water. We all agree on that. And like, yes, you pay a little bit more so that someone way the fuck down the road can have a standard of living that, you know, is humane and, you know, up to the standards of, you know, American values, right? So like just the core concept of running the country like a business should have been a like nuclear red warning to everyone about, you know, this kind of infrastructure destruction. It's just wild to me that a lot of people saw that and said like, yes, yeah, we absolutely should run the country like a business. It's like, that's a pretty big miss.
Right now, what we're doing is we're basically making every single person in America sit down and come to their own conclusion through like personal reinvention of the wheel. The idea of democracy or the idea of government, like just having a government. And I think a huge part of this is that our education system has well and truly failed, massively failed. If people don't understand that like a business has different incentives than a government should, and that's correct. Like a government's job is to take care of and provide for the people, and a business's job is to make money and create, like, exchange goods and or services. And they're built in separate ways for that specific reason, because we agreed that human beings have inalienable rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Like that's the baseline, that a child should have an education and enough food and water and enough medical care so that they can get to be 18 years old and have a life. Like, if we can't agree on that, and this is the same people who are always crowing about like pro-life stuff, and it's because I don't think that they've truly sat down.
And their love of the Constitution.
And I don't think they've sat down and like stitched these things into a cohesive philosophy. Like, right, like they're reactionary takes born out of ignorance and stubbornness that they refuse to shift or change or admit we're wrong, and they can't stitch them into a cohesive, like the Darwinistic, like Atlas Shrugged Ayn Rand objectivism doesn't jibe with half the shit the Republicans want and would die on a hill over. And
well, one of the things that I think is absolutely nuts is that like my parents, right, like they are balls to the wall libertarians, right? And it is amazing to me to think that, like, if I went to them, and I guarantee you this is the fact or this is the case, like if I went to them and I was like, you know, schools are getting defunded, they have, you know, teachers get paid nothing, and the quality of the education is really terrible, they'd be like, yeah, well, you know, I don't think we should have to pay to educate everyone's kids. And like, if they had not had the public school system when I was a child, like my family would be destitute because my mom would not have been able to work. The only way we were able to pay for anything is because both of my parents worked. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And like to just immediately forget that everything that they have right now is predicated on some level of public infrastructure, it blows my mind. Like how, I don't understand.
I mean, it's the thing. And again, like all of this is stuff that like, we generations of people understood and were taught, and it was like a core, they were taught ethics and philosophy and morals. And like, yes, there was also a time of like rampant racism, right? Like there were some high highs and some low lows. Nobody's arguing that like the founding fathers were perfect people, but there was whole generations of people in this country that like believed in those core ideas and were taught those core ideas and took them for granted that I think eventually, you know, you have the greed is good era and you have this like, when all of that baseline stuff is taken care of and the country's like super rich, you can start being like, fuck everybody. Like, why does it matter? Like, everyone will be fine. And if they're not, then they should have said fuck everybody. And like, you being, when you don't have like a core of like a philosophy that you believe and understand resulted in your current circumstances, of course you have no value of anything. Of course you take everything for granted. And you know, these are discussions that I had in high school in like AP US history courses or AP government courses. Like, these are discussions that we had as a class, and these are discussions that I had in like higher education. And I think I was very lucky to have teachers that were impassioned enough to do this with us, because when they didn't have that. And so they either came to this information through like forums on the internet or books they took out of the library of their own accord. And it's frustrating for me because like, I would love to move on from this. Like, I don't you are a selfish sociopath, having public roads that are maintained benefit you. They benefit you because you can go places, but also you want the people who are consumers of your goods and or services to have enough like ability and money to get to your store and purchase them. And that's what makes the world go round. And when all children are educated, they can come up with innovations when they're working for you. Like, I don't understand. Even if you were a business tycoon sociopath, you want your populace to be able to like have a certain standard of living because it benefits everybody. And this like hoarding of wealth is so, it's not only short-sighted, it's nihilistic, it's fatalistic, it's just this twisted ugliness.
You know, I mean, that's the other thing too, is that we have basically no, and I need to emphasize this, that I did not receive this education when I went to school for economics, but we don't have historical economics, right? So like, I don't remember, I do. Like, we are past the point of inequality that we were in the Gilded Age. Early in the United States history. And like, you know, when the people in the Biden campaign, even if they're just like loosely associated, you know what I mean? And they're not making any policy decisions, are talking about austerity in the midst of, you know, a very, very, very severe depression. You know, like in the midst of like staggering inequality. And the Democrats are not talking about doing anything about it. Like, the notion that the CEO of a company makes 300 times what the workers make is an extremely modern phenomenon and, you know, is not the way the world inherently must be. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. That happened relatively recently, you know, post-industrial revolution. And, you know...
But these groups of people... Yeah. They defend it as if it is the way it is, not only always been, but it would be un-American if it was any other way, which is just like
wild,
like false on its face. Like the America you're talking about, the Make America Great Again, the America in that statement, I imagine you're thinking of is the 50s and 60s. And if that is the America you want to go back to, it's not going to have CEOs making 300 times more than the workers. That's not America was. No,
that's the thing is that like when the thing that they want to go back to is actually the New Deal. They're
yes,
like,
100%.
Know, they forget that happened, that, you know, like we had unimaginable investment in public works,
We decided as a country to create and maintain the middle class. We said there should be a middle class so that people will be able to move between the classes and there is an incentive, quote unquote, for people to get up and be a part of society and be productive members of society. And is that social engineering? Does it work that way? I don't know. But we decided that we were going to create the middle class for that reason. And like now they want the middle class back, or they say, or they like report that they want the middle class back,
yes.
But they don't want to do any of the stuff that got us it in the first place. It's just very confusing.
No. And when that middle class, you know, part of the New Deal, you know, part of the economic miracle that happened was World War II. You know, we made everything for everyone across the entire planet, right? But like, that's not going to happen again. Or God, you know, God forbid that happens again, right? So like, if we believe in the middle class, which I think is a big question, you know, if we believe in the middle class and we acknowledge the fact that we are not going to have a post-war, you know, economic explosion, then we have to raise, you know, we have to raise everyone up. There is literally not another way to do it. So like, you it's a pretty simple choice. Either we have a complete and total oligarchy in the country, right? Mm-hmm. Or we invest in infrastructure and people and a middle class. Those are the two options. And like, you know, American nostalgia is actually middle class, right?
Yeah.
So it's a little confusing.
Some people are nostalgic for the 20s, but nobody's nostalgic for like, you know, yellow journalism and like the jungle. Nobody's nostalgic for like dying from scurvy or like dying of like, what is
polio.
It? The Oregon Trail, polio
dysentery. Yeah.
Dysentery. Nobody's like diphtheria. That's what I'm nostalgic for. People are nostalgic for the glories of war, the boom times of the 20s, and the middle fucking class, and that's it. And then there's some Madonna in there towards the end. Nobody's nostalgic for anything else.
So I mean, like, listen, and we've seen that, you know, this particular like instantiation of the GOP, right, where it's just grievance politics, it's just hate, it's just contrarianism, you know, it's just divisiveness, like that can't solve problems. You know what I mean? Like, there is no capacity to solve a problem like a pandemic when all you have is anger on the shelf. You just have different cans of anger, different flavors of anger that you've accumulated through, you know, your think tanks over the years. Like, and you can't pop any of those open and solve a problem like a pandemic, right? And you can't even really pop them open and solve a like serious recession/depression, right? Like, yes, you can get a little bit of a something something going from a tax break and, you know, a little bit of quantitative easing. But like, once it gets like serious for real, those things don't actually like work. So, you know, and I really hope, and the thing is that like on the one hand, the fact that there's still a 42% of people out there who are supporting Trump is, you know, really discouraging. But at the same time, like, people are smart, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, a lot of people are dumb, but like, a lot of people are smart, and they may not know anything about politics or really the economy, but like, you know, there's enough people out there, I think, that are like, has my life gotten better or has it gotten significantly worse in the last 4 years?
And also, let's remember that he didn't win the popular vote. Like, as much as it's so annoying to keep saying it, it sounds like butthurt emails or like this won the internet.
Yes,
but
yes.
He did not win the popular vote. And so like, even with all of these forces, even with all of this dogma, even with like a lack of education, voter suppression, he still didn't really win. He only won on a technicality. So like, there is some level of like hope that we have a resilience built up, but I don't know. Guys, vote for Biden, but also, like, it's okay to not enjoy the DNC.
That's the thing is that, like, once Biden, God hoping, God willing, you know, once Biden is president, we need to rip the Democratic Party to smithereens. Like, it's comical. Like, what, you know, I remember before I was at Input, you know, we were at an outline party, and I was ripping on Nancy Pelosi, and Josh was like, "What are you talking about?"
Oh yeah, Josh, like, Josh stanned Nancy Pelosi for a little while.
Huge Pelosi stan. But like, yeah, I absolutely agree that, you know, she is very effective at politics, but like, her idea of what the Democratic Party should do blows my mind. Like, this, you remember the debate about like whether like we were like, Trump should be impeached. And Pelosi was like, I don't know.
She's really good at a politics that is eroding away if it exists at all anymore. Like, she's really good at the politics of like, okay, so we've got this info to move over here. We'll make a deal with these people. We'll get some donors to do this. We'll move this around. This will keep the people happy and healthy, but not give them too much. Then I've got to make a deal over here. And it's like, that's great in a world where like, you're not dealing with a cartoon character with like cartoon bombs running around fucking tweeting at the top of his lungs. Like, that's just
the
a
idea.
Different scenario.
Yeah, just the idea that like reaching across the aisle is, and the other thing too is that like, you know, I I'm not necessarily, you know, I'm not really like griefing Nancy Pelosi. There has just been such incredible missteps. I mean, and she's responsible for them to a certain degree. Like, you know, they hold the budget. The fact that they didn't absolutely twist Republicans' balls off immediately after the first one. I mean, even the first one was not enough. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, the knife was all the way in and they decided not to twist it for reasons I'll never understand. You know what I mean?
And like, honestly,
maybe these people are so rich
scared.
That they just can't get it. But yeah,
they're scared of the blowback. But like, I don't think they understand that, like, thanks to partially Trump, but also just because of the state of the current world, the media, like the pace at which we live our lives, people don't fucking remember shit from 3 weeks ago. They're not going to remember that you like
Absolutely
twisted
not.
The knife. That's why he's president. Like, wake yep. up. It is not the 80s or the 90s anymore. Like, you have to get with it. We are in like the fucking future. I need you to like. Well,
and I think there's a real, like, the establishment Democrats, I think, really don't understand that the core strategy of these new Republicans in some states is not to solve problems. It's not to legislate. Like, the what their constituents want is for them to own the libs. Their only function, like, Matt Gaetz is not judged by what he gets done in any capacity. He's only judged by his constituents on how well he can own the libs.
Laura Loomer just won a primary and she doesn't even own the libs well. She just intends to and tries to do it a lot. She's just constantly trying to be a troll. And so people like want to elect her to public office. And it's like, did we read as that smug? Did the West Wing piss you off that much?
Like, I know. That's the question. It's like, I see this all the time. If you put in put in the words liberal and despise on Twitter, you will see an unreal number of people just out there being like, I despise liberals. And it's like, I mean, like, I'm pretty upset with the GOP right now. But like, you know, the instinct to use this sort of like dehumanizing language and like, you know, you're literally on Twitter telling people that you hate, you know, a fellow American. It's like, it's an interesting.
Well, I think a little
situation.
Bit of that is like a it's a resentment of intelligence and anti-intellectualism mixed with good old fashioned racism and anti-Semitism mixed with like a vague hatred for women, homophobia, and also like a class resentment. And when you mix all those things
That's
together,
fair.
You do get the modern idea of a liberal, which is like Will Truman and his like tuxedo going to like an opera function. Do you know what I mean? With his black boyfriend.
Yes.
And so you can pick whatever you want to hate there. And it's a little, I understand the like identity politics of it, but they're the same group of people who's like, fuck identity politics. And it's like, wait, no, what you're doing is, oh, anyway.
Yeah. Yes.
All right. We should move on to something else evil.
We should.
This week I wrote about, and, you know, feel free to get mad, Tony. I wrote about the company Analog and whether or not, they're evil.
I love this piece so much. I really did.
People
so you
got mad about
blowback.
The headline.
Yeah.
Yeah, people didn't like the headline. But the thing is, I was trying to be tongue-in-cheek and sort of like, obviously we live in a world where like there's a lot more evil stuff. But also like, they're a capitalist company, so they are also like quite obviously evil. But I wrote a piece about the company Analog, which I'm sure Tony knows about because we've talked about their products ad nauseum. But basically, I tried to come to a conclusion of whether or not by being like a big fan of theirs, I was rooting for the bad guy. Because they are a private corporation and they don't seem to be a very nice one. Like,
absolutely not.
They work in the FPGA space where the community is very about open source and very into connecting and relationship building and sort of this like utopian common ground because we're all interested in this one thing and we're all passing ROMs around for free, right? Like, and they came in and they created a closed source product that is extremely exclusive in limited quantities. And they charge hundreds of dollars for each thing. And they don't participate in the community. And in fact, they create a hierarchy within a community that was very flat and egalitarian. So I felt this growing resentment with them. I mean, they've got terrible customer service, which doesn't help matters. They like wildly overcharge for basic things. They do these exclusivity drops because they want their product to be more covetable, even though that's not the only way to make your product covetable and buzzy, you know? And so I just grew to resent them pretty badly after the buzz of like getting my Pocket pre-order in. And I don't know. I mean, did it read to you that I was like way off base in bullying them? Because that's the response I got.
So I am really glad that you wrote this piece, because if I had written this piece, I think it would have been a bloodbath, because like, you know, I can't tell you how excited I was for the Pocket. Like, you know, some of the consoles that they have, you know, they're a little bit more expensive. I like that they exist, but it really didn't, they don't really speak to me.
I mean, it's a lot of money to play Sonic.
Right, exactly. And like, but when the Pocket came out, I was so excited. And, you know, the thing is that like, you know, I think that you were really measured, because like, you know, not what Analog is doing, like, you know, this sort of like, you know, using drops, which, you know, just in case it's not, you know, it's not clear, what they're doing is they're creating an artificial scarcity, right?
Yeah.
And like what Analog has become really good at is, you know, is using every psychological trick in the book to sell their products. And like, okay,
their marketing is slicker than Apple. It's like more manipulative than Apple. It's wild. Yes. They're so good at it.
They're so good at it. But the thing is that like, you know, I understand that, you know, Nike and Apple, you know, Apple themselves, you know, they need to use brand marketing to, you know, the, you know, the, like shoes, for example. Shoes work because it is there's a season to fashion, right? And you need to get people excited about a thing that continually comes out that like they may or may not need. You know, after you get past your like 10th pair of sneakers, I think it's pretty, you know, have a different type
with
of thing.
iPhone, yeah.
Yeah. And like, but Analog is not that kind of product. And, you know, I was going to give them my money. I was going to purchase the Pocket. And I mean, I threw a little bit of a hissy fit, and, you know, I don't want to support a company that does this type of thing. So I decided not to purchase it. But like, lo and behold, then they were sold out instantaneously. And like, you know, I have talked to a lot of companies in the course of like reporting just in the last couple of months who have all had supply chain issues, but everyone is telling me that their supply chain is going to normalize in like the next 2 months.
Well, so this idea, also the thing of they're placing a pre-order for a product that was announced a year ago, won't be delivered for a year, and likely won't do another round of orders, like another drop, for at least a year. So
yeah.
There's really no reason. That's no excuse. Like, you haven't built any yet, so you can't tell me you only have so many.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, there's a lot of bullshitting going on here. And like, that's what I'm saying is that like, when you contaminate my sort of like hobbyist nostalgia, you know, like it's all fun and games when you're like downloading open source products, like you were saying, and like playing around with a mister and like, you know, putting boards together and Raspberry Pis. But like by the time you're using like Apple tier psychological weaponry for marketing, like not my favorite, not really. It really ruins it for me.
Well, the thing that, and you know, it's funny that I dropped this piece this week, and I got the blowback when I did, because immediately afterward, later this week, the Telfar bag thing happened, which if Tony doesn't know, because I wouldn't expect Tony to be like, you know, keeping up on the most fashionable purse. The Telfar bag is, it was called the Brooklyn Birkin for a while because it is a slightly more affordable, like it's only a few hundred dollars to purchase outright. And the resale market isn't quite as insane as it is for a Birkin. And if you don't know what a Birkin is a purse you spend $25,000 on and you can't get wet. Mm-hmm. And it's like it's forever. Ever since Jackie O carried one, it is forever a staple of like making it, like having insane wealth. And so if you have a Birkin, it's a big deal. So the Telfar bag was available in limited quantities, and it was vegan, this vegan leather, and it's very chic. It comes in a limited amount of colors. And it was just kind of this it item. And Telfar decided that they didn't like that status. It felt wrong for their brand and for who they were. So they opened up pre-orders where instead of having to like hunt one a bag down on eBay and pay some insane markup, you would be able to just pre-purchase a Telfar bag. They would have it made for you by a certain date, like the end of the year / January of 2021, they're saying. But anyone could have one. And that moment of like a drop, and there is exclusivity and you do have to kind of be in the know, but anyone can have it. And it's not that expensive. It's not so expensive in comparison to other stuff of its caliber and fashion. It was so revolutionary to me. And we're all at home now, right? Like, so we're not buying fashion to show off that we have something you don't. It's just something that like we want. And so it's a better consumer experience if I know that like I want it and I can get it and I will get it. And I might not have the chance to buy it again. And that's a little bit manipulative, but like, it is a good feeling to be like, it's a better consumer experience to be able to purchase the thing you want rather than to feel this guilt or that I didn't wake up in time or like this, like, you know, this resentment that you didn't get a chance to have it. Like, that's a negative experience that you don't feel good coming off of.
Right. And you don't want to have a person's primary interaction with your brand to be with a reseller on eBay. Like, that sucks.
Yeah, and that's what happened to me with analog products. So I bought an accessory from them. And like, long story short, I bought an accessory from them. They announced that they had produced them wrong and that they would damage your console if you used it. So I said, hey, when can I get the replacement? And they said, oh, we're going to give it to the person who originally bought it. And I was like, well, you only produced so many. And the person who I bought it from purchased a bunch of the stock so that I wouldn't be able to buy it from you. And so then I was like, I'll just pay you outright to fix it or I'll for a replacement. And they wouldn't sell it to me. So I had to wait for their time to drop and repurchase the same thing again. And like, no matter if it's my fault, no matter if you can come up with a way to blame me, it is a terrible consumer experience. I walked away hating that.
That's the thing. It's like, and you don't even need to do that. Like, I'll give you an example, like, you know, Boosted Board. You know, for all, you know, the company's out of business now. And like, they were massively, massively overhyped, you know, by, you know, the Casey Neistat, like, YouTube explosion. You know, no disrespect to Casey. I'm just saying, like, it just got way overhyped. But like, they would go above and beyond, you know, like, you've got a problem with your board. They're like, you know, don't worry, we're going to send you a whole new truck. Like, you know, they knew that they were trying to grow their business. You know, they wanted to scale, you know, they wanted to sell boards, right? And like, even though they took like a bit of an L on the customer service, you know what I mean? Like, that's why they had just an absolutely frothy user base. You know what I mean? Like, people were going out there and evangelizing Boosted Boards to an incredibly annoying degree. But like, that's why, is because, you know, these are things that, you know, these are, you know, devices with moving parts, they break down. But the customer service experience was like, you know, say no more. We've already, you know, we've got a thing in the mail to you. It didn't matter if you bought it or not. They never asked anybody for any receipts for anything. They're just like, give me the serial number of what you got and, you know, we'll send you something. And it makes, I mean, listen, it makes a big deal, or it makes a big difference.
Yeah, it makes a big difference to, I mean, not only does it make a big difference to like your consumer base and to their experience, but it also makes a big difference in someone's like day to day, right? Like, because philosophically, if your brand stands for exclusivity, if your brand stands for luxury and this idea of, and I mean, maybe it also ties into, so Bon Appetit, which is a food magazine. We can't get into all of it, but they disbanded over some racism scandals, even though they had like one of the biggest hits in old fashioned media breaking through to new media ever. Like, they had the Friends of YouTube. And they had this network of chefs that were just so likable and they all interacted and it was like a big sitcom and it was a huge success, but they didn't want to pay their non-white performers as much as they were paying their white performers. And there was no world in which they were going to do that. So most of the talent has left. And they basically ruined their whole thing. People are now like, well, Condé needs to, like, how are they going to change? What are they going to do? Like, how can we hold them accountable? And I mean, it's the same thing that I'm feeling with, like, what we're talking about with analog, which is like, when your brand is built on luxury and exclusivity, that's always going to come back around to, like, I don't like poor people, which because we live in a racist society, is I don't like black people, or I don't like gay people, I don't like people who don't have as much capital to spend or can't get into certain places, because my job, and I exist to either show you those places or to like advertise them to you, or to report on like New York society, right? Like if you're Bon Appetit, it's to take me into restaurants I could never go to and ingredients I can't get at my local supermarket.
And people knew the Bon Appetit chefs' names, like all, like, I don't know, like 12 of them.
They knew their like kids' names. People were like really engaging with these brands. And it was like a high low of like these ingredients and these ideas are so high, right? But like, they're just like us. But it's the same thing.
I mean, massive missteps. I mean, yeah, I mean, we don't have to go into the whole thing with Bon Appetit. I mean, massive missteps everywhere. But like from a basic show business standpoint, like, you know, people don't know.
Friends was super racist, but they had a hit on their hands.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's it blows my mind. It just blows my mind. Like, how do they not have a meeting where they like, you know, with the board and like, listen, we just need more budget. We just need to pay everyone the right thing. And they just be like, sorry, now everyone gets paid good. Like, I don't understand.
It brings me back to the analog thing, which is like, I feel like your brand is built on exclusivity and luxury. So maybe at the end of the day, I just don't want that anymore. And I get that, like, I wanted a Game Boy to play. I didn't necessarily want to buy into like a luxury lifestyle brand with like drops and like tiers of like, I got the collab version and I got the, and I, you know, all of which to say, like, I know
it's
that we've been talking this whole episode about inequality and about sustainability, because like ends up that's fucking everything right now. Ends up that's like the biggest thing in the world, and it's shaping like every facet of everything.
Yeah, I mean, you know, that's the thing is that like there's no, you need a community of goodwill to have a long-term business, right? Like there's a reason why like people stan Patagonia so hard, because I mean, like, listen, you know, Patagonia, REI, they don't have, you know, they try to be sustainable, right? You know what I mean? But they're a corporation. Or I mean, REI is a co-op. But do you know what I mean? Like, they're still existing in this sort of, like, way.
They exist in a capitalist system.
Yes, exactly. Yes, thank you. But, you know, they're doing their best. And the level of goodwill that people have towards them is what has created their businesses, right? Like, the reason that, you know, these businesses are not, you know, still operating out of someone's garage is because they were able to scale because they have a big community behind them. And like, you know,
that's also true with Apple and Disney.
Yes. And Nintendo too. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, Nintendo's not out there trying to, you know, they want to ship as many Switches as they possibly can. And there have been some stock problems from Nintendo. And I really, you know, I mean, I don't know what's going on there, but like, I kind of chalk that up to just Nintendo's not always the best operational business, you know?
Yeah, no, they're bad at a lot of things, but they're good at IP management.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. But like, you know, nobody's out there trying to, you know, Apple's not like, sorry, you can't buy an iPhone. We ran out of iPhones. Correction. It's not that we ran out. It's that we really only want to have some people to have them. So I don't know, man. Like, I don't know anything about the CMO over at Analog, but like, maybe the board wants to think about the long-term, you know, viability of their business. Very short term thinking from Analog's part, and not the best.
So in the news this week, it was announced that Oculus, which is a subsidiary of Facebook that creates VR headsets, was going to require every user of their product to log in with a Facebook account, which had previously not been the case, but similar to Instagram and WhatsApp, Facebook is trying to fold in all their various different services so that you need to have a centralized account that they can have all your data linked to. And they can also authenticate your identity. And people in the gaming community are furious about this.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, there's not that many VR headsets that are really on the market, right? There's the Vive, there's the Oculus, and there's the Sony one, right? So like, you know, having one in this sort of locked down you know, Facebook infrastructure. It's really a lot of, I imagine there's a lot of Oculus customers who want to use the Oculus because they are nice, you know, but don't really have an interest in being on Facebook proper.
Yeah, I think it's similar to when people say they want to delete their Facebook, but they never say they want to delete their Instagram. It's that it was being run as a separate business and a separate entity for so long that people got this brand affinity or a product affinity, and they didn't really sign up to have a Facebook account where their high school friends could DM them. And they didn't really sign up to be like in this giant world phone book, right? Like, and also they didn't sign up to be part of a service that is undermining democracy and is taking strong political stances or non-stances, which are also political. And when you bought this product 2 years ago, nobody told you you were going to have to do this, right? It's kind of a bait and switch. And I think you buy into something like this, be it a game console, a VR headset, a phone, and you're thinking to yourself, like, this is an appliance. And now Facebook is saying, no, it isn't. In fact, it is it's a global identification system and a global data tracking system. And we're going to use it to spy on you, essentially, with your permission. But you don't really get the option of saying no. So how much is that really permission?
And in the context of, you know, just a couple weeks ago, we had the antitrust hearings, you know, which, you know, Mark Zuckerberg was a part of. And it's wild to see Facebook like running as fast as it can to integrate all of its products, because, you know, the closer everything is integrated, the more difficult it becomes to simply break it apart. Like, the crisis scenario for Facebook is like some pieces of it start to get chopped off, pieces that it spent a lot of money to acquire, right? Like, you know, it would be very easy to be like, Oculus, you're your own thing now, bye.
This is the strategy that Microsoft tried to use in the 90s when regulators stepped in. They said, we can't take Internet Explorer away as the default browser because we tied it into the OS in all these ways. And it ends up the legislators broke them up anyway.
And it was great for technology.
Yes, that was, and it was a wonderful thing that it happened, because there was an explosion of innovation in the space. And is that a foreshadowing of things to come for Facebook? Who can say? But certainly I'd keep my eye on what's happening over in Zuckerberg's kingdom. So it's been over 20 years since Sega launched the Dreamcast, which was its last console in the video game marketplace. And it ends up the Dreamcast is having a long, long, long life afterward, because fans who have never really let the console die continue to develop new games for the platform and distribute them online. And because the system was so easy to crack and so easy to work around its DRM, you can basically burn onto a CD all of these quote unquote new high quality games. And there's five of them coming out for 2020.
It's nuts. And that's, you know, I had a Dreamcast and I bought it way after its lifespan, specifically because, you know, you can just run unsigned code on a Dreamcast. And, you know, the nerd cred is so good. So to see five like real actual games, you know, it's like a really cool vindication of, you know, people like me who have very anti-DRM stances, because like these games are cool and like they're real.
Yeah, and the thing that's so interesting is that Sega, for all of their missteps as a video game company, and if you're unfamiliar, Sega took a lot of chances in the 90s with a lot of different products, and a lot of them didn't work out, and a lot of them competed against each other, and it ends up that wasn't a very good business strategy. But by the end, they had created the Dreamcast, and this console was extremely experimental, and it was extremely forward-thinking. Like, it was launched in 1999, and it had online gaming. It had multimedia playback. It had a Switch-like accessory where there was a screen in your controller that you could take portably with you, similar to a Game Boy, whenever you left your console. It had just tons of features that you don't see even today properly integrated.
Like Halo wasn't even like a glimmer in anyone's eye when Dreamcast was thinking about online gaming.
Yeah, I mean, it had a game where it had a microphone you attached to your controller, and you could talk to the character, and it was basically like a pet simulator. And those kind of forward-thinking ideas created a community that is now launching games like Slave, Xenocider, Intrepid Izzy, Arcade Racing Legends, and Xenocrisis, which will be launching in 2020. And these are all really high-quality games. Like, Intrepid Izzy looks to be an amazing platformer in the style of, like, Mario or Wonder Boy and Monster World, and you've got like Arcade Racing Legends, which looks like an incredible racing game in 3D.
Blows me away. Like, how did they make that? You know what I mean? Like, there's no like engine just out there that you could just pick up and be like, I think I'll make a 3D game today.
Yeah, this is fans' commitment to actually seeing this happen. I mean, these were projects that took entire companies to do in the 90s, and people are doing them themselves, and not for really any profit. And it's that kind of like passion that you love to see, because you know that a game isn't being like created in a boardroom to be the most marketable or the most monetizable thing. It's being created because it's someone's pure artistic vision. So if you have a Dreamcast, or if you've got a local used video game store in your area, I would recommend picking one up, because all of these games are free and you might be able to transport yourself back to a more simple, pure time when technology only made us good promises.
I want to go back.
Take us back. All right. Well, I can't talk anymore about how the haves have and the have-nots do not. So let's talk about nice things. Did you have anything this week that was nice?
Actually, yeah. So I just got my hands on a sewing machine. I, you know, have had one before. You know, I've done some sewing projects before, but they've really been like, you know, I need to hem some pants, need to repair a shirt or something. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And this time I went in, I got a Singer heavy duty sewing machine because I needed to make a bag, like a heavy duty, like really strong bag to hold a battery inside this e-bike that I just made. But you know, this battery weighs like 10 pounds, so it needs to be like pretty serious material. And you know, the first one I made two the first day, right? The first one I made, you know, it definitely did not look great. It was very, very first ever product. But then I immediately went and just made a second one, and it honestly looks fantastic. And it was really fun to do. The first one took me like 6 hours, and then the second one took me like 1 hour. It was crazy and very fulfilling, I will say, because I just, you know, I made something from, you know, total parts, and just it became something. Also, I will say that like being in New York is very handy for this, because I went down to the garment district and I felt pretty fancy, because I was in that fabric store with all these very fashionable people. I was like, whoa, I didn't even know this existed.
Cool. That's so interesting. Yeah, I've gotten a lot of like use out of, I mean, maybe like 3 or 4 times a year, but having a sewing machine and knowing how to use it, like it just saves you so much trouble. Like it's a thing that everyone should know how to do. Like everyone should know how to sew, and knowing how to do it, it's like knowing how to cook. Like you can actually like tangibly save yourself money and trouble. And it's honestly kind of fun to have like a little craft that you're doing.
Yeah, I mean, if you use textiles, which is every human being, like you should have... I mean,
maybe a little bit less in quarantine.
Well, I guess that's true. Well, that's true. That's true. But like, no, I met somebody the other day who was like, oh man, I gotta like re-sew the zipper on my backpack. And I was like, how are you doing that? He's like, well, I'm gonna do it by hand. I was like, oh, well, you know, it's gonna take a really long time, but...
Best of luck.
Best of luck. Immediately elitist. I'm like, well, yeah, well, you're not in the sewing machine game. What about you?
So this week has not been a great or fun week, but I will say I have very much been enjoying, there's a television show on Netflix called Glow Up, and it is it's sort of like the Great British Bake Off or any of those competition shows that have evolved to be like very nice. And it is about makeup artists who are competing to be like the next makeup artist. And it's so interesting because obviously it's a very femme art form, but it is very different than something like RuPaul's Drag Race, because these are very much not performers. These are people who like really love the art of painting faces to be like works of art. So, you know, you've got people who just love making like sex bomb porn star looking faces. Mm-hmm. And you have the people who like love like the intricate detail of like traditional geisha painting. And there's the whole spectrum in between of like of artists. And it's so funny and interesting. I mean, it's set in the UK, so a lot of the makeup is a little spackly, let's say, a little heavy-handed. But it is really fascinating to watch these artists who are like semi-professionals and probably have nowhere to really, I mean, like Instagram is a place that they like, makeup artists tend to have like an online community, but there's really no way to, other than that, to like celebrate your art form, right? Like,
totally.
You can get likes on a finished product, but other people are doing that digitally with like Facetune and also earning those likes. So to really show off your process beginning to end and the amount of work and skill it takes and the raw finished product completely untouched, unairbrushed, unfiltered, just like what you accomplished and what you pulled off, just given a complete stranger's skin. It's crazy. Yeah. And it really opens your mind up to like, sometimes there is a value to just picking one thing in life. I'm very much a dilettante.
Oh, yes.
I'm a jack of all trades. You're the same way, where like, absolutely, we like to pick up lots of little skills and know like a lot about every little thing, which is great as a writer. Like, for our job, yes, that's awesome. But sometimes I'm like, there is value in like finding your one niche and just getting incredible at it.
Yeah. Well, you listen, I watched the first season of Glow Up, and you know, at first it didn't really hook me, right? Because like, you know, the beginning episodes are very like game show, like Netflix game show style. Mm-hmm. You know, where you got it's a lot like, of
who will do the eyeliner perfectly symmetrical, yes, in 30 seconds or whatever. Yeah.
And you've got some jokers, right? Like, you've got some jokers, but like by the end, like, you know, by the time they're down to like the last four or five, I was like really rooting for these people. It's no longer just like a, you know, like a bozo, like Netflix constructed scenario. It's like, these people really want it. It's cool.
Breed of reality shows, because, you know, I mean, everybody knows I love Real Housewives. Potomac is having a wonderful season. I love drama, but these new breed of nice reality competitions actually don't foster that kind of like clownery and behavior. But when you get to the end of these competitions, for the most part, you just have like charming, hardworking people who would otherwise be unremarkable if they didn't get to show off their talents. Like, they wouldn't stand out in a room as like, well, that's an obnoxious personality who's destined to get attention. They would just be like a nice, friendly person who's really good at their thing.
Yes. They're trying.
The second season even hones in on that more, and they're more selective about the people who are in the crowd. And there's one person I find very annoying. And if anybody watches the show, you're going to know exactly who's pissing me off. But for the most part, they're really supportive of each other. And even when the competition gets really intense and towards the end, they're helping each other pull off their art, because they do realize that at the end of the day, it's great to win the $100,000 or whatever, but everybody just really wants to show off what they can do on TV. And that,
so they can get a job. Nice. So they can get like a job at Sephora, honestly. Like,
yeah. So they can get the Instagram followers and the like bookings to like, you know, do a cool thing with a magazine. So anyway, I really enjoy Glow Up on Netflix. I would recommend anybody check it out, even if you, Tony, have no interest in blush. It is a fun, interesting subculture, and I'm all about diving into new subcultures. So that's how I got in the STD clinic. Anyway, that was a bad joke. Okay. Well, I guess that's it.
I think it is.
Thanks for being our guest host.
Listen, happy to do it.
All right. We'll have you on soon. Bye.
Bye.
Well, that is it for this week. We'll be back next week with more tomorrow. And as always, I wish you and your family the very best. Though I am hearing that Facebook is requiring you to log in with a Facebook account in order to be part of that family. So, hope you didn't value your privacy.